Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
The new tools that a metaverse can bring allows you to create more immersive content.
Companies are beginning to sell less oil, more electrons.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The supply chain breakdown is combining with labor shortages.
Will Eastern manufacturers continue to dominate, or will there be a renewed interest in Western manufacturers?
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we will dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets. Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide. Today, we take a look at a possible big win for M&A bonds. Plus, can OPEC Plus ease oil market anxiety? But first, let's get into the interest rate story. The Federal Reserve has been busy. Rates are going up. The question is how much and how quickly. To get the latest, we check in with Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence interest rate strategist. So, Ira, the market recognizes that the Fed has been very clear about raising rates here. Give us your sense of how you think this cadence of rate increases will play out going forward.
Yeah, so I think, Paul, what happened at the May meeting was the Chair Powell made it very clear that they were going to go in incremental steps of 50 basis points. Well, he did say at least 2, and I think the market took that kind of in an awkward way and said, oh, if they're only going 2 at 50, then they're not going to hike as much as we thought, and then the markets were very volatile around that number, taking out a hike, adding back a hike, and then taking out a couple of hikes again when the equity markets swoon there for a little while. So I think that it really is going to be in 50 basis point increments, maybe throughout the entire year, because if inflation doesn't come down very much, the Fed is going to be in inflation fighting mode. And that means more and more interest rate hikes if inflation stays high.
It's been a while, Ira, since, you know, investors and consumers have had to deal with high inflation environment and one where the Fed really wants to get into inflation fighting mode. How effective can the Fed really be here? Because it seems like a lot of the inflation that we're seeing out there, whether it's at the gas pump or in supermarkets, is maybe more supply side driven, i.e. I can't get stuff. The supply chain's all messed up.
Yeah, well, I think it started as supply side, but because wages were relatively tame for such a long time, I think the employees now are asking for wage gains. And the fact that you have people working from home, it's a little bit easier to maybe get job interviews and switch jobs. So you have a number of – the quit rate is very high, so you have a lot of people switching jobs for higher paid jobs. And then because of that, you then have other companies that are saying, well, we want to keep our employees, especially the good ones, so we're going to give them wages to keep them here instead of them going away. So I do think that there is a little bit of a wage spiral going on a bit, and it does show up in some of the data. So when you look at some of the wage data, for example, from the April payroll report, even though it kind of missed expectations, it's still running at a very healthy clip in terms of weekly wages. So I do think that it's sustainable. The question is it's sustainable at 2.5% or 3.5%, right? That I think is the question, and that can't be answered until we get a lot more data, right? So we won't know if the Fed is going to be willing to hike more and have to hike more to fight inflation, or if when they get to 2.5-3%, you wind up seeing things like corporate hiring slowing down, wage growth slowing down because companies are afraid that their cost of capital is going up. So I do think I do think they'll be able to fight inflation. The question is, how high do they have to raise interest rates in order to actually fulfill that goal?
Interesting. All right. So rates are in fact going up. Talk to us about this, I guess, fiscal tightening, not fiscal easing, but the exact opposite, fiscal tightening. How will the Fed affect that?
Yeah, so I don't think the Fed can affect it directly. In fact, I think there's two interesting things with the fiscal situation. So one is you're not likely, particularly in an election year, to get an additional fiscal stimulus package going through. But you did have in 2021 massive fiscal stimulus on while the economy was very strong. So you are seeing some give back from that. And eventually that will have a detrimental effect probably to growth. And you're seeing that at the margin right now. I think when we talk about the other thing that higher interest rates do is it will increase the interest cost for the federal government. You know, like one of the reasons why the federal government was able to issue so many bonds at such low yields was meant that they haven't seen a significant increase in the amount of interest that they have to pay just because they're refinancing higher coupon debt, so debt that's say 5% interest rates with a 0% interest rates. Now they're going to have to go the other way a little bit here. So over the next couple of years, you could wind up seeing more interest payments made by the federal government, and that will have will basically limit the amount maybe that the federal government can do in future fiscal stimulus plans.
And what finally, Ira, what's the Fed doing with its balance sheet?
Yeah, so the Fed did announce that they're going to be reducing their balance sheet a little bit differently than we expected. But at the end of the day, they're going to be rolling off $60 billion of Treasury securities every single month by September, and then whatever prepayments of mortgages happen that in those months. People say that it's $35 billion of mortgage runoff, by the way, but by our calculations, they're never, ever going to hit that until interest rates go down quite a lot. So they're going to be running off their balance sheet. That means that the money supply and all of this excess liquidity that was put into the markets and the financial system over the last 2 years is going to start to be drained. It will take a long time, though. You're probably talking about next summer, maybe the third, fourth quarter of 2023, before you get to a point where you're going to see probably a significant impact of financial conditions because of the Federal Reserve's runoff.
All right, Ira Jersey, good stuff. As always, Bloomberg Intelligence interest rate strategist Ira Jersey. Coming up on the program, why OPEC Plus members are struggling to keep up with targets. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, right now, let's take a look at the global energy business. When you think about global crude oil, you have to have a call on the demand side. You have to have a call on the supply side. Fortunately, our next guest does have all of that work. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Energy Analyst Salih Yilmaz joins us. Salih, talk to us about the supply. And when I think of supply, the first question I guess you have to go to is OPEC Plus. I mean, OPEC's got to be pretty happy. Got oil, you know, around $100 a barrel. That's pretty good. But don't they have the pressure to increase supply to make even more money?
Absolutely, Paul. I think that's a good question. And we do think about OPEC and now OPEC Plus when it's the supply side of this equation. And at current prices, pretty much all member nations are enjoying the current pricing environment because this is much higher than the fiscal break-even for these countries. So this is very good for them. But obviously, it is perhaps above the sweet spot for them, which means we are running at levels that may be demand destruction zone for them. So I don't think they want oil prices to be perhaps as high as they are right now. But obviously, while they are, and you're not seeing too much of demand destruction given the market circumstances, so they for sure are enjoying the current environment.
It's really interesting. I'm surprised, I guess, although I don't watch it every day, that they have been so determined not to raise. You know, they've been pretty good about keeping their quotas and keeping the price higher. Are you surprised that OPEC has had this type of discipline?
Yes and no. I mean, in the beginning, we thought, especially with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the potential disruption that could come from there, it was surprising that they kept rebuffing the calls from outside to increase output faster. But then, I mean, they've just kept saying that the market is actually balanced. But the thing is, when we look at the last few months and what happened to their supply, they are actually really struggling to increase supply anyway. So the current plan is for them to be increasing output by a modest amount of 432,000 barrels per day every month. And to be honest, when we look at April, for example, they barely increased the output in the month of April anyway. So what we're seeing is that majority of the member nations in the group are probably at or near their maximum capacity. So other than probably only Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and maybe Iraq, the rest of the group just does not have the capacity to increase output anyway. So yes, we were surprised that they just did not completely rebuffed calls. But what we're realizing is that they really probably, it doesn't really matter what they agree on at these meetings at this point, because they really just can't increase output by that much anyway.
And I'm guessing there's a very long lead time to say, hey, we want to increase production 10%, 20%, 30%. It's going to take a while to get that capacity, right?
That's right. And that's why we always talk about spare capacity because, I mean, of course, some of these countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE at the moment obviously do have maximum sustainable capacity levels that are above their current levels. So for these countries, it is relatively easy because they are artificially keeping barrels off the market given this OPEC Plus pact. But for the rest of the group and for the wider market, yes. I mean, it is not something that could be done overnight to just say, okay, let's invest more and then in a matter of weeks you have more supply. I mean, most of these oil projects have multi-year timelines. So the investments you're making now, you would start getting supply from these projects in more than a year or two. So that's why, I mean, it is very difficult to get that supply back into the market.
So you mentioned Russia, and you know we see talk that Europe is really trying to wean itself off of Russian oil. Can they, in fact, do that? And if many European countries are able to do that, doesn't that make a tight situation even tighter?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I mean, what we've been concerned about since the beginning of the invasion in Ukraine was that we would already see a lot of self-sanctioning. So even though there are no direct sanctions on Russian energy in Europe right now, we thought initially that most companies, most refiners would just refuse to buy Russian crude anyway, which would lead to large disruption numbers. But I should say that so far, I mean, the disruption from Russia and Russian oil flows have only been limited to about 1 million barrels per day, which is lower than our initial estimates and I think estimates by many agencies. But obviously, I mean, as you mentioned, the European Commission is discussing the next sanctions package at the moment, which is very likely, it seems, to include direct sanctions on Russian oil and gas.
So that would, of course, mean, and this is what the BP CEO said at their earnings call, is that this would certainly mean potentially much higher disruption from Russia. And he mentioned 2 million barrels per day, which would be about double the amount that we've seen so far. So, and what can the European refiners do? I mean, of course, there are some alternatives. We're already seeing more demand for Middle Eastern crude, for example, that could come seaborne into Europe. But obviously, the majority of the pipeline capacity into Europe is from Russia. And this is the cheapest way for these European refiners to get that crude. Getting it from somewhere further away via the sea is obviously going to be more expensive for these companies.
So in terms of the global supply out there, where is the U.S. here? Has the U.S. stepped up its production of its shale product?
It is, and it is, I mean, arguably the swing producer, if you will, at the moment. And we are watching this very closely because when we look at OPEC, as mentioned, there's huge shortfalls. And I mean, if we're only relying on OPEC for this demand gap, we may be in trouble, especially towards the end of the year. When we look at the U.S. shale, we know it is below the maximum level that we saw years ago. And we are seeing a kind of capital spending and investment coming back into the shale sector, but arguably too slowly and too cautiously. When we look at the U.S. shale sector, the companies are very much focused on shareholder returns at the moment. And I mean, shareholders don't at the moment want them to talk about output growth because these companies had a decade long of low return rate, high reinvestment rate. So these shareholders really want them to be disciplined and to return those returns back to investors.
Got it.
This means that investment is coming back, but perhaps not as fast as you would have otherwise thought, given how high oil prices are. We will see if this will be enough to fill in that gap in the supply-demand balance in the oil market.
Great stuff, as always, Salih Yamaz. He is Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Energy Analyst. Coming up on the program, when it comes to REITs, industrials are likely to continue to be among the top performing of the year. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide. All right, right now, let's turn our attention to real estate. Specifically, I'm talking UK and Euro REITs. Where is the hot spot to be within the real estate space right now? For that, we welcome senior real estate analyst Sue Munden, Bloomberg Intelligence senior real estate analyst. Sue, thanks so much for joining us here. I want to start with industrial REITs. We just get some really good manufacturing data here in the States, and I'm wondering if you're seeing that over there and whether the industrial REITs are performing as well as they are here.
The industrial REITs in the UK and Europe as well have been sort of riding a wave that's been driven actually more from online retail and being able to support the logistics facilities than it has been from manufacturing or and data centers is the other big driver. And it's been incredibly strong. I mean, SEGRO, one of the largest logistics REITs in Europe, reported 1Q new contracted rent up 56% year on year. So there's a lot of momentum in that market. However, I am a little bit concerned about what is happening going forward with retail sales. So perhaps if I can give you a little bit of background.
Sure.
Online retail sales in the UK tend to spike up in November and December every year and then collapse. And the peak-to-peak is about 12 to 13% growth because we're penetrating the market more with online sales. And the peak-to-trough can be as much as 40%. What happened with the pandemic is obviously we had to go online. The peak shot up 63%.
Wow.
From December 19 to December 20. But in 21, it went down. Now, if you're a retailer, you need to be able to cope with the spike. So you generally have to have excess have been trying to sort of spread that out with Black Friday, you know, just sort of spreading it over November into December. But nevertheless, they need to be able to cope with it. And if that spike goes down, and they've already been able to cope with a bigger spike in 20, then the demand that has been, you know, really persistently high for extra warehousing space may start to fall back.
Have we seen any signs of that? Because it feels like the consumer is still spending. Yes, we may be shifting our spending away from stuff to maybe more experiences, going on a trip, taking a cruise, but they're still spending. But are you seeing any data that suggests that, you know, this may be an issue?
Yeah, in the UK, I mean, if you look towards the rest of this year, we've got a joint squeeze from high inflation in both fuel and in food costs. So discretionary income's coming down, and that is expected to spike later in the year, and there's another squeeze on fuel costs for the house in sort of October. So just before the sort of peak season, you're going to see that the consumers have felt a squeeze. So I am concerned about that, yes. I think that if we're seeing a situation where online penetration has sort of almost maxed out at about 30%, it could go to 40, and you're also seeing a decline in retail sales, then the chances of the spike being that much higher than it was in 2020 is highly unlikely.
So how about on the supply side? Here in the States, they're just building these fulfillment centers and warehouses pretty much everywhere you can look. Is that similar situation in the UK and Europe?
Yeah, it certainly has been. I mean, the REITs have really tried to leverage this huge spike in demand, and they're building like crazy. Some of it is built to suit, quite a lot of it, so they've already got a tenant in place. Some of it is speculative. I mean, the stats for 2021 were that the whole year take-up was 4.4 months of supply. So very, very tight supply demand. So this, you know, if it does loosen the market a bit, if the demand pulls back a bit as a result of this, it might just be a healthy thing, especially if the discretionary income situation turns out to be just a one-year phenomenon, and then UK goes back to growth once the inflation settled in.
Just in general, Sue, we're in a rising interest rate environment pretty much across the board. How do REITs typically perform in that type of environment?
It does depend a lot on which sort of industry they're focused at. So the industrial REITs often have a CPI, you know, an inflation-linked uplift in their rent deals. So yes, they benefit from higher rents as that happens. In other areas like retail, where, you know, obviously they've been faced with a lot of headwinds recently, and this may be another one, rents have come down, and it tends to be a base rent with a turnover-related increase. So they don't get the inflation increase rise unless things are going well. And then in offices, again, that tends to be fixed for a period. So it's a bit mixed from the rent perspective. From the interest rate perspective, most of the REITs have hedged their debt. And those that haven't, there are a few that tap the short-term commercial paper market. And I'm a bit more concerned about them, but it's a very, very small segment. And again, most of them have hedged most of that as well. And their liquidity is sufficient not to worry if that market closes a bit.
All right. Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Susan Munden, getting the latest on UK and Euro REITs. Coming up on the program, we go inside the world of Canadian M&A. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Swinney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, it is time to talk banks, and this week we are going to focus on Canadian banks. We've got interest rate rising. Question is, how are these banks going to perform with a rising interest rate environment? For that, we welcome Himanshu Bakshi, Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst. Himanshu, talk to us about the Canadian banks, their balance sheets. Let's start with their balance sheets. How's the capital looking here?
Canadian banks are one of the most capitalized banks in the world. But what we expect in 2022 is their capital ratios to decline. And there are three reasons why we say that. First is, in a rising rate environment, the banks have securities portfolio. And if they designate that securities in those portfolio as fair value through OCI, the unrealized losses in that security portfolio flows through to their capital ratios, regulatory capital ratios. And that will lower their CET1 ratios. The second impact we are seeing is from growth in risk-weighted assets. So Canadian banks' risk-weighted assets are expected to increase by 8 to 13% this year. And so that will drive common equity Tier 1 ratios down because CET1 ratios are calculated as capital over risk-weighted assets. And the third is that most of the banks have made recent acquisitions, and they're big acquisitions. So that will also drag down their capital ratios in 2022.
That's kind of where I wanted to go. I've been noted, again, some pretty good M&A activity in Canada. Toronto Dominion acquiring First Horizon, $13.4 billion. I'm looking at your research.
That's
Bank
right.
of Montreal, mm-hmm. Bank of the West, $16 billion. What's the drivers behind these deals? And are the balance sheets prepared to handle it?
So yeah, so first I'll talk about the balance sheet. So over the last 2 years, what has happened is the regulator actually put restrictions on buybacks on all these Canadian banks, and they were not allowed to increase dividends. So as a result, banks have accumulated a lot of capital over the last 2 years, as much as $60 billion for the big five Canadian banks. And what we saw in December with Bank of Montreal deal and then in February with TD, these banks were always looking to grow in the United States. And so we saw that some of the previous deals that they did years ago. And now they had the balance sheet, they had the capital they needed for these deals, so they could go out and do all these deals with cash. TD had about $20 billion in cash.
Wow.
BMO had about $13 billion. So it's a good use of their surplus capital, I think.
As we think about the big Canadian banks, and their balance sheets are in better shape, mm-hmm. And presumably that'll stay the case, are they returning capital to shareholders? Where are
they
we on that
are,
front?
They are. So they started doing buybacks, and almost every bank has actually started doing buybacks. They have increased their dividends. In U.S., what we saw in the 1Q earnings was that big U.S. banks, some of them actually stopped buybacks because they had the same issue because of unrealized losses on their available for sale security portfolio. Their capital ratios went down. We expect the same impact on Canadian banks, but we don't expect them to stop buybacks, other than the banks that have stopped buybacks because of the acquisitions like TD and BMO. And the reason for that is, if you look at the CET1 ratios for the big U.S. banks, they're in the range of 10 to 11%, except for Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs because of the high requirements. But in Canada, the big Canadian banks have CET1 ratios from 12 to 15%. So they have a big cushion compared to the big U.S. banks. So the impact will be different.
Rising interest rates, good for the Canadian banks in general? I mean, I'm thinking net interest margins, will actually be a positive story.
That's right. That's right. So rising rates are always good for the banks because it increases net interest income, and increase higher net interest income is higher earnings, and higher earnings lead to more capital accretion. So that can offset what I just talked about. Yes, but overall, yes, we expect profitability to improve at Canadian banks because of higher rates.
How are the bonds performing here for some of these Canadian banks?
Canadian banks' bonds always trade tighter than most similarly rated banks in the world. So if you look at the Singapore banks or Australian banks who are like kind of in the same rating category, Canadian banks always trade tight, and we expect that to continue this year.
How is just the economy, when I think about some of these the banks, particularly, you know, not the big superpower New York money center banks, I think some of the more regional banks, and the loan growth has been not as high as one would think. And I guess that's a lot of the stimulus that was put into the economy. But how's loan growth looking up in Canada?
So the banks are projecting especially in mortgages, they're expecting loan growth to be mid to high single digit. But we do expect with rising interest rates, mortgage loan growth actually to go down. And the reason first is because of the house prices have gone so high.
And the housing market, I'm just recently learned, is such a big part of their economy and a big part of consumers' assets.
That's right. We do expect actually mortgage activity to go down. Two reasons. First is because of just unaffordability, because house prices are so high that more people actually were taken out of the market because of that. And the second is rising rates. So when you're in a rising rate environment, now it's more expensive for you to borrow to get a mortgage. So because of these two reasons, we expect actually mortgage activity to slow down this year.
All right, good stuff. Himanshu Bakshi, Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst on those Canadian banks. Thanks. From Canadian banks to Canadian telecom. Well, we've got a big, big telecom deal pending in Canada, and we want to get a sense of what's going on there. What does it mean for the creditors of these two big giant companies? For that, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior credit analyst Stephen Flynn. All right, Steve, talk to us about this deal. We've got Rogers Communications, Shaw Communications. Those are the two big telecom companies in Canada. They're trying to get together. How's that going?
It's not going so well.
The regulators have got to be like, what?
Yes. So this deal was announced about 14 months ago. It is a huge deal. Rogers agreed to acquire Shaw for about $26 billion Canadian. And the important part here is that they need $19 billion of cash to do the deal. And what we're seeing right now is that the regulators are starting to push back. They were told over the weekend that the regulators will sue to block the deal. And so they're going to try and figure out a way to solve that.
And this is just simply, you can't put two big telecommunications companies, I don't know how many more there are in Canada, I can't imagine too many more. And if you put these together, that has to be a competitive issue.
Exactly. The big issue is wireless, right? So they want four big wireless competitors in the market. Right now, you've got Bell, you've got Rogers, you got TELUS, and then now there's Shaw. Shaw has Freedom Mobile, which is their mobile business, which they want divested. And the regulators want to make sure it's in strong hands that can compete going forward.
14 months is a long time here. What are the antitrust people? I know at Bloomberg Intelligence, we have some people who just look at this kind of stuff and give you some good guidance. What are you hearing?
Yeah, so the big question out there is whether they can find the right buyer, so the right person to divest the Shaw's wireless business, and therefore that they're a strong competitor in the market going forward. And I think that is the sticking point, and we'll see how the negotiations go. But there's really an interesting twist here with regard to the bonds, because there is a potential positive bond catalyst that could happen here, which, you know, in this market with rising interest rates, falling bond prices, this could be a big surprise if the deal fails.
All right, so
ironically,
so it fails,
bonds benefit if deal fails.
How's that?
Well, the company, like I said, needs $19 billion Canadian in cash to pay the Shaw shareholders. So what happened was, deals announced, they put in $19 billion of backstop financing, committed credit facilities from the banks. So what typically happens with an M&A deal is, as they get closer to close, don't forget, Rogers was saying, you know, last month that they expect this deal to close by June 30th, right? So we're getting close. Everything appears on track. Let's go do the bond financing. So what they do is they go out into the bond market. This happened on March 7th. They sold dollar bonds. They sold can dollar bonds, total of about $13 billion Canadian equivalent bonds to finance the deal. And what's typical in an M&A transaction is they take that cash, they put it in escrow, pending the deal close. Key point here is, if the deal fails, the bondholders get their money back plus a slight premium. So they would get get 101 cents on the dollar.
So what's the, I mean, if I'm a bondholder, do I then want the deal to fail?
Yes, you do, right? Because what has happened? What's happening? What's the most important story out there? Rising interest rates. So they sold these bonds on March 7th. What has happened over the past 7-8 weeks?
Yeah.
interest rates have gone up, bond prices have gone down. So some of these bonds have fallen into the low 80 cents on the dollar, right? So I have a bond, rates are going up, I'm getting killed here. Oh no, this deal could fail. Wait a minute, I could get what they call a special mandatory redemption. Deal fails, they have to give me 101 cents on the dollar. Wow, I could get rescued here and get back par plus a little bit. And it would be a very positive development for the people that bought these M&A bonds.
Whatever attorney put that into the credit agreement, you know, earned his or her fee, that's for sure here. All right, so from a strategic perspective, what's the feeling in there? Should this deal get done? I mean, is this new company really exciting?
Yes, it is exciting because don't forget about the cable side, right? We've talked a lot about the wireless side where there's the concerns about competition. But, you know, Rogers is doing this for cable. So Rogers is also one of the biggest cable providers out there. Shaw is a big cable provider. They don't overlap. They have separate territories. They can come together and gain scale. You know, not too different from what we've seen pass in the U.S. here with like a Charter buying Time Warner Cable many years ago.
How are the cable bonds trading? Because I used to follow the cable industry from the equity side, and the story is cord cutting. And is that still, how are those bonds trading?
Yeah, that is a big concern, right? So cable was a great model to lend to, right? Yep. You lend it to them, they provide video, then they built out broadband, they were crushing the telco guys with regard to broadband market share, bringing customers, produced huge amounts of free cash flow, and you felt comfortable with, you know, moderate leverage given, you know, the cash flow. What's happened though is that all across local communications provider, we're seeing a huge step up in CapEx as people need to invest in their networks to provide faster broadband speeds to get those broadband customers. And so we're seeing a lot of competition from the local telcos and the cable companies. So what's happening, particularly for some of the high yield ones, maybe like an Altice USA that has a little bit of a stretched leverage structure, it's getting a little bit harder now, right? Because cash flows are being squeezed over the next couple of years as they're spending all this capital to invest in their networks. And therefore, bondholders are getting concerned because leverage is going to stay high for a while. So you've really seen a backup in some of the high yield names. Some of the more quality names like a Charter, like a Comcast, they may be off a little bit, but that's more of a rates than a real credit quality concern issue.
I tell you, it's good stuff. You, as a credit analyst, high yield guy, that's a great space. Telecom, cable, capital intensive businesses, always buying bonds, selling bonds, trading bonds. It's a good place to be.
Yeah, always something going on. Just hang around long enough, a new story develops.
Exactly. All right, Bloomberg Intelligence senior credit analyst Stephen Flynn. That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.